You may recall that we started this summer sermon series back in June, talking about cures from the Psalms. We talked about fear and worry and depression, and then in August, when we started back again, about doubt. Today, it's indifference. Each time I told you that the sermon title probably promises more than a 20-minute sermon can deliver, because I know some of these maladies have plagued you for a long, long time, and to think in 20 minutes I was going to produce a cure seems a little bit improbable on my part and on your part to believe, but it is a way of getting your attention. Getting your attention about these things that dominate our lives and asking the question, why do I allow these things to take over my life at times? Also, it gave us an opportunity to look again at the Psalms. The book of Psalms is a wonderful resource for worship, both public and private. And I challenged you on that first Sunday in June, perhaps for the summer, you would want to read through the book of Psalms. And if you started on that Sunday and read about two a day for most days of the week, excluding Sundays, you would arrive at the end of the book of Psalms about August 23rd, which is today. So you perhaps have finished up today or last week or next week, depending on what your reading schedule has led you to do. Now, is anyone willing to hold up their hand and say, I've read through the Psalms this summer, Reverend? We had one at 8:45. Well, I would suggest if you started on that, you might want to pick it up again. It's a great thing. Good things happen when you read the Bible. Our word today is indifference, a cure for indifference. Now, indifference may not sound quite as tragic as fear and worry and depression and doubt, but it still causes a lot of problems. If you dug into those two hymns we opened with this morning, you begin to see where I'm going. Because at times, people allow their faith to become indifferent. Indifferent means a lack of interest, concern, or sympathy. Now, none of us would want to sign on to that intentionally, would we? Oh, I have a lack of interest, I have a lack of concern, I have a lack of sympathy. Lack of interest. She asked him what he wanted in his salad. He shrugged his shoulders in indifference. Someone told me at the door after the early service, I'm pretty indifferent about what you said this morning. I said, you got it. Football season starting soon. How would you feel if we had an indifferent quarterback for the Bulldogs? I don't know if I want to play quarterback or not. You know, those big guys are charging at me. I might get hurt. On the other hand, maybe I can lead the team to victory. I don't know. What do you think I should do? How about breakfast? Some people are indifferent about what they eat for breakfast. Cold cereal, a little English muffin, maybe some scrambled eggs or fried eggs, a little bacon, a little sausage. I don't care. Well, I tell you who does care. The chicken is involved and the pig is committed. I don't want an indifferent airline pilot. I want that airline pilot to be completely in control and focused on what he or she is doing. You know the story about the airplane that was flying through turbulent weather? And it really started to get rocky. And not only were they going like this, but they were going a little sideways. And so everyone pulled their seatbelt just a little tighter so that they were really attached to that seat. And you could see worry and concern on the face of everyone. And then suddenly the cockpit door flies open and out steps the pilot with a parachute on. He says, don't worry. Stay calm. I'm just going for help. Now, you can probably imagine that I don't like indifferent parishioners. I mean, after all, anyone who stands up here on Sunday morning and says, startle us, O Lord, startle us with the wild improbability of what we say we believe, that does not call for an indifferent response. That calls for you to give me something back. In John's book of Revelation, the last book of the Bible,
In chapter 3, he's writing a letter to the church of Laodicea. Do you remember that? He says to them, I know your works. You are neither hot nor cold. And because you are lukewarm, I'm going to spew you out of my mouth. Spit you out of my mouth is what it says in the new RSV. Now, what do you do when you're served lukewarm food? We know what to do with hot food, right? We just let it sit there a little while, unless it's pizza. And then we probably are willing to burn our mouth just because of the way it smells. And we know what to do with cold food. I once was at a fancy club in Houston, and they served us cold potato soup. Now, that's the way it's supposed to be served, right? Vichy choix, they call it, French soup. While I was sitting there enjoying my soup and salad, a minister came in who was late. He sat down beside me and started gobbling down that soup, and after about three spoonfuls stopped and said, this is cold. They served me cold soup. A few people chuckled. Most just stared. And finally someone said, well, that's French soup. It's called Vichy soup. He didn't say another word through the whole meal. There's nothing worse than a cold baked potato. But lukewarm food, what do you do with lukewarm food? Well, usually you dig around right in the food thinking, I know there's some warm food in here somewhere. If I can just find it, where is the warm food? Indifference, a lack of concern, interest, or sympathy. The psalmist wrote the 85th Psalm about 530 BC. It was during the history of God's people when they were prisoners in Babylon and then being released to go back to the promised land. In 586, Jerusalem fell when the Babylonians carried the best and the brightest, those who could do something. They carried them off to Babylon as prisoners, as servants, as a way to infuse their economy with some good workers. That's what ancient despots did. They felt that if they scattered the population amongst their own people, then they were less likely to ever rise up against them. But in 538, Cyrus, king of the Persians, conquered the Babylonians, and Cyrus was a benevolent king. He was the first of the benevolent kings who said, no, I think people do best when they are resettled in their own homeland. If they are sent back to their ancient homelands, then they will see that I'm good, and they will live there in peace. So Cyrus said to the Jews, first time that they are called Jews, by the way, in the Old Testament, referring to the land from which they came, Judah, he said to the Jews, you can go back home if you want to. And so all of a sudden, these people who didn't think they were ever going to see Jerusalem again or ever decided, yes, we'll do that. Now, they had been there 50 years. A couple of generations had been raised up, some of them who had never seen Jerusalem, never seen the promised land. All they know is what people had told them, how beautiful it was, land flowing with milk and honey. Oh, if we could only get back there someday. And so enthusiasm ran high. They were passionate about going back. And when those first pilgrim caravans pulled out from Babylon on the way back to Jerusalem, you can imagine how enthusiastic they were. They were going home. How far was home? Not far. Just about 200 miles. And when they got to Jerusalem, what did they find? Not much. Little shanties. Burned out buildings. Ruins. Something you would expect after 50 years of no one living there. Oh, there were a few people hanging around. A few who were descendants from those who had been left behind, the non-skilled laborers, the day laborers we might call them, those who had little initiative about life in general. And there were some squatters, people who had just moved into those old burned-out buildings. So what do you do? What do these enthusiastic, righteous pilgrims do? I mean, after all, this is our place. We're back home now. What are you doing here? And so they evacuated the place. They sent all the squatters away. Leave, leave, leave. Please go away. You do not belong here. You don't belong among us. Go away. And what do we do whenever we clear out a place? Well, the first thing we do is start to build a wall, right? When you want to get undesirable people out, you build a wall, and then you police the perimeter. And so that's what they did, and they made sure those squatters and those non-desirable people never came back, because they were the pure Jewish people. They were doing this for God. God had called them back to this place. And so then they enthusiastically started building that wall. And after 2 or 3 years, they had got the wall up to about 3 feet. You can imagine, if you've been working on this for 3 years and it's about 3 feet. And the temple, they hadn't even started on the temple yet, 3 feet. And so they started getting a little unenthusiastic. They started wondering, what are we doing here? And then the worst thing happened. A drought came. A drought. And all of a sudden, there was no water in the wall, nothing to mix the concrete with. You know, what do you do? How are we going to get out of this? And that's where the writer of Psalm 85 shows up. They were saying, what's going on here? Is God punishing us? Because after all, the ancient Old Testament world was a world of cause and effect. If something happens, it means that you have displeased God. You've done something against God. And so God is now punishing you. Remember the story of Job? That's what the story of Job is not so much about patience as it is a righteous man has been accused of doing something wrong. That is what his friends come and say to him. For 7 days they sit with him, don't say a word, but on the 8th day they begin saying, Job, you need to examine your life. You've obviously done something wrong. You have offended the deity. You've offended God. You need to figure out what you've done wrong and then beg God's forgiveness. And Job sits there and gets angrier and angrier, because Job said, I have done nothing. No, I've not done a single thing. I'm still a righteous person. That theology, though, worked its way all the way down 600 years later to the time of Jesus. Remember when Jesus, when he heals blind Bartimaeus there in Mark 9? A man who had been blind from birth, and the Jewish authorities wanted to know immediately, who sinned to cause this man's blindness? His parents or his grandparents? And Jesus would have none of that. Jesus said, this does not represent anyone's sin. No one's sin is here. He was born blind, and now I have healed him, and now he is well. Now, this theology, by the way, keeps weaving its way, showing up in almost every generation. Today, we see vestiges of that. Something bad happens to someone, and we'll say things. You will hear someone say, well, why would God allow that to happen? Or I wonder who did something wrong that would happen to that person. And so, the writer of Psalm 85 speaks into that world. He starts by saying, God is a generous God. I proclaimed when I read the first 3 verses the brief summary of the mighty acts of God. God has forgiven you in the past. God has forgiven your sin. He has restored you to righteousness, is what the psalmist writes in those first 3 verses. You have been indifferent from time to time, he says to them. Oh, you had great faith when Moses led you out of the land of Egypt across the Red Sea, when the Pharaoh was pursuing you with his army with great pursuit. But once you got into the wilderness and settled down for a few days, and you began thinking about that promised land and how good it was going to be, you said, well, we don't really need God anymore, because we can take that land all by ourselves. And that kind of indifference towards God cost them 40 years of wandering around in the wilderness. In fact, the history of God's people is a history of mountaintop obedience and valleys of indifference. Things haven't changed a lot, have they? I mean, after all, when we're in trouble, we ask God to help us, but when we get out of trouble, we say, thank you very much, God. I can take it from here. That tends to be what we say to God. They even say, will God's anger be forever? That's how short those people's memories were. Is God never going to forgive us? Because it always seems there's something working in our lives that we can't quite figure out, and God just won't shower us with blessings all the time. I wonder why that is. Will you not revive us again so that your people may rejoice in you? Show us your steadfast love, O Lord, and grant us your salvation. It's like God had never given that to them. The psalmist says, listen, people, God has restored you many times, and he will continue to restore you. The cure for indifference begins with the understanding that God cares about us, that God is for us, that God voted yes for us. And he expects us to be obedient. He expects us to return that love. Not just for a short period of time when we get out of trouble, but he can ask us to continually live as God's righteous people. Continue to live as God's caring people. Continue to tell others about this God who cares so much about them. That's what separates the Judeo-Christian tradition from the other religions of the world. We have a God that cares about us. We have a God that tries to be in communion with us, a God who wants us to love him, a God who wants us to return that love that he showed us in the life of Jesus Christ. Won't you please show that love? For your faithfulness will spring up from the earth and your righteousness will fall from the sky. It's like Jeremiah said, there will come a day when God's laws will be written on your hearts. There will come a day, Isaiah said, when the lion and the lamb will lie down together. There'll come a day, Mary said in her song when the angel had spoken to her, when the hungry will no longer be hungry and all will be fed. Speaks of a day. Now you can say, Reverend, when's that day coming? And it's a day there waiting for all of us in the future, a day when all of God's promises will be revealed to us, a day when we will see the pure salvation of God for all of God's people. God cares about us, but see, you and I are part of the equation. You and I have to take that caring from God and deliver it to other people. Because there are always people who say, well, if God cares about us so much, then why does he allow all these bad things to happen? Why doesn't God just kind of fix it all? After all, you know, lots of us would like a Wizard of Oz God, right? Who can fix it all if we can only find the wizard. If she could only find the wizard, everything would be all right in that story of the Wizard of Oz. Where is that Wizard of Oz God? God loves us and God cares for us and God wants us to be part of the equation. So when the terrible hurricane bore down on New Orleans 10 years ago, did God care about that? Or did God say, well, that's just your problem. I'm going to let you fix that for yourself. Well, God, yes, God cares about that. God cared about the people of New Orleans. God cared about the eco situation there. The trouble was there were not enough good people, some of whom are religious, to speak up and challenge the developers when they said, we can fill in this bay, this would be no problem, because that big hurricane they're talking about is never going to come. And so they filled in that bay, and the hurricane came, and everyone wondered where God was. No one asked, where were those people who were raising those concerns? The Holocaust. Why did God allow the Holocaust to happen? Did God not care about those people at Auschwitz? Certainly cared about those people. But the trouble was there were not enough good people, some of whom were religious, to speak up and challenge the demonic doctrines of Nazism. You see, we need to be part of the process. Why is there always problems in the Middle East? Doesn't God care about those people in the Middle East? After all, that was God's territory, wasn't it? Yes, and God cares about those people in the Middle East. The problem is there are not enough people, some of whom who are religious, to speak up and challenge the political situation in the Middle East that allows 30 million people to live forever, and for some of them it is forever, in refugee camps, where they've totally lost hope, where they've totally lost any possibility of a future that they can see in their life. Not enough people who cared. Now, I'm not playing a blame game here. I'm just suggesting that God's caring for us is part of a formula that we not only respond to God out of love, but we respond to the peoples around us out of love, and that we respond to the situations around us and speak in Christian love as to what's going on in the world around us. What voices are we listening to? Are we listening to voices that give us the answer we want to hear? After all, it's someone else's problem. Or are we listening to the voice of God who calls us and tells us that what we really need to do is retell his story over and over again? For some of you, back in the 80s and 90s, Seinfeld was your favorite hit TV program. I know there were even Seinfeld watching parties. Their final episode, which aired in 1998, but it's been in rerun now for a long time, so perhaps you've seen it a dozen times, like me. Their final episode, their four main characters, Jerry, Elaine, George, and Kramer, are on a private jet flying to Paris, but they have plane trouble and they have to land in this small New England town. And while the plane's getting fixed, they wander downtown to this small New England village. Now remember, it's a comedy. They come upon a scene where a very overweight man is being carjacked. And the funny part of it is the carjacker can't get him out of his small car. He's trying, he's pulling on him, and he can't get the man out of the car. And so they look at this and they start joking about, look how overweight that person is. Look at the trouble that carjacker can't get him out of the car. And they do nothing, except for Kramer, who videotapes the whole thing. He thinks he's going to make a movie. And finally they get him pulled out and the guy drives away. And the four of them have done nothing. They didn't know the man. They didn't want to get hurt. They didn't want to get involved. So all they did was stand there and stare and shrug their shoulders and walk away. Indifference. Whose story is it anyway? And don't we laugh until we cry? God bless you, everyone.